Hi, I'm Jason Nias, along with Natalie Wires from Digital River, an e-commerce and payments company dedicated to helping brands go global and grow their revenue. But this isn't about us. This is Commerce Connect, a podcast about people who are creating some of the best e-commerce experiences of our time. Listen on to hear from e-commerce visionaries as they look back on where they started and lessons they've learned that have gotten them where they are today and what they believe is the future of online shopping. Hi, everyone. This is Jason Nias from Digital River, and I am excited to welcome our guest today, Paul Lynch, who's the CEO of Chargify, a company that offers recurring billing systems for Web 2.0 and SaaS companies. Welcome, Paul.
Jason, thanks for having me. Great to be here.
So let's start off. Chargify is a really cool company who I'm really getting to know more now. Would you give our listeners an introduction to Chargify?
Absolutely. Thank you. I mean, I think it's a pretty cool company as well, thus being in the chair here. Chargify is a billing and subscription management company. Our target market specifically is around B2B SaaS players, but we, being an established company since 2009, we have a large cohort of customers right across multiple different industry sectors. We're soup to nuts, if you like. So we do everything from managing the product catalog in terms of what you're delivering out to your customers, pricing, add-ons, all the way through to payment processing with integrations into payment processors, Digital River being a key one of those. So,
fantastic. Yeah, we're obviously very excited to be working with you guys. We think very highly of your products and your services. You know, one of the things that I was very interested in is a little bit of the origin story of Chargify. Obviously, you've got a Mark Cuban connection. Can you unpack a little bit about how Chargify came to be?
I can, of course. It's, as I said, it's a mature company in terms of the explosive kind of world of SaaS, both B2C and B2B, where we have an enormous amount of, you know, startups happening on a weekly, monthly basis. We're seeing, you know, seed capital, angel investments, all the way through to later stage investments. I mean, coming across a business like Chargify that's had a tenured kind of role here since 2009 is a little bit off the norm, I feel. So, yeah, we were established even before 2009 when we became our own separate entity. We actually were the billing engine for Grasshopper, which was a hosted sort of IPPBX business going back into the 2000s. That business successfully exited to Citrix for a very good return to its founders, Dave Houser and others. Prior to that exit, they had spun Chargify out as a separate entity. Their seed investor on it was Mark Cuban of the Dallas Mavericks fame. He'd come in, he put money in, and the business continued to grow in the emerging sort of subscription billing market. And in 2016, it was acquired by Scaleworks. Who are Scaleworks? Scaleworks are what we call a venture equity fund that resides in San Antonio, Texas. Their model would be not to come in and make, you know, smaller investments and hope to see the business hockey stick, not to come in, buy the company outright and look to derive a return in terms of distributions and dividends, but to come in, take a majority interest in businesses between sort of $3 and $10 million in revenue and operate those. Increase value and increase the customer base by bringing in their methodology around sales, marketing, centralizing executive management teams into San Antonio. And, you know, they look to operate these businesses. So we're operators for the Scaleworks Venture Equity Fund. And they've been the beneficial owner, if you like, of Chargify since 2016. And for all intents and purposes, they've been a really, really great partner. In that period of time, the business has been very successful. We have strong growth. We have a strong, loyal customer base. And, you know, as we come into 2021, we all believe Scaleworks, the executive team, myself, that, you know, the sky's the limit for B2B SaaS and for those kind of support companies that sell into them.
Fantastic. And, you know, for our listeners are probably picking up a little bit of the Texas accent. Is that right?
So no, I'm not a born and bred Texan, unless you consider North Dublin in Ireland as being a suburb of Texas. It is a pretty large state, but it doesn't quite traverse the Atlantic Ocean. No, I'm an Irishman. I came out to Texas with a previous investment from Scaleworks back in 2016, a company called Assembla, which worked in source code management and sort of project management as a software on a software level. And I operated that business from 2016 through to a successful exit to Idira, a Houston-based fund, a Houston-based operating entity that was backed by HGGC Capital out of San Francisco that was doing a roll-up. So in late 2018, post that exit, having had a bit of a holiday in Ireland, I came into Chargeify in 2019, and I've been in situ as CEO since.
Fantastic. Thank you for that, taking my setup. I really, I've known you for a little while, but I've done a little bit of research on your background, and it's very impressive. There's a software background, telco, hosting. You've had a number of exits. You've had an IPO. What attracts you to the industry of billing? What is it about billing that you see as a good place for you to grow your career?
Yeah, it's you mentioned my background. And telco is a key component of my background. I spent several years in telecoms. When I left college, university, my first role was in the developing world. I went to South Africa where I worked for a drinks company. When I came back to Ireland in 1998, we were deregulating the telecoms market. So what I mean by that is most smaller kind of economies had a single telecoms provider that was state-owned. The deregulation process that occurred in the late 90s, right across the world, introduced competition into what were, strictly speaking, monopolies that were controlled by the state. That's where I worked. I always worked in smaller, scrappier kind of telecoms that competed against the incumbent in Ireland. And all these businesses had one commonality, and that was we couldn't bill. From the outside, looking in at your utility, be it power, be it telecoms, be it a hosting provider that's delivering you an outsourced solution, be it a software company that bills you on a subscription level, you feel that, the generation of a bill on a timely basis every month at the same time that goes out to you and, takes money out of your card is just it's a process function. It's not. It's hard. Okay. You go into the telecoms world 25 years ago, it's even harder. Because you have hundreds of thousands of customers. And if you do a wrong bill run, it ends up in the daily paper, where people are saying that you were overcharged by AT&T or overcharged by Verizon. So right throughout my telecoms career, one of the which had like successful exits, and we had an IPO at an alternative investment market in London, one of the things we always found, bill run was always difficult. And it was always an area that fascinated me. Why did it need to be so difficult? And then when I saw the emerging kind of SaaS players come up, your Zoras of the world, your Chargeifys of the world appearing, and selling this on a almost from a billing perspective, almost to a utility level itself, but on a low cost, relative ease of use kind of structure, and enabling smaller companies to come into the subscription market, I was really interested. Marry that to the fact that your B2B SaaS world, the business cycles that occur here today, 2021, they're far quicker. Emerging companies arrive quicker. They gain dominant positions in the market faster than we've ever seen before. And the one thing that they need to do to be successful is they need to be able to bill effectively, and they need to be able to collect effectively. And collection is no longer, I mean, I don't want to sound ridiculous, but it's not a tin can on the desk where people are putting dollar bills into. This is around businesses like Digital River that are able to traverse international borders, that are able to manage, currency exchange and fluctuations, are able to, bring payments across in a secure, both like secure from a cash collector, but from a cyber perspective as well. with low fraud, with fraud mitigation and everything else, and are able to deliver that out. So, I mean, that's why it interests me. I think, you know, the King of Ireland, Bono from U2, said a couple of years ago that, you know, startups were the new rock bands. I thoroughly believe that. I see young, really competent, driven individuals on a daily basis coming out of places like Dublin, Austin, San Antonio, Boston, New York, and they don't actually want to be rock bands. They don't want to emulate Bono. They want to emulate Elon Musk. They want to emulate Mark Benioff, and it's exciting. And these guys all have one commonality, and that's they need to be able to effectively bill their customers. They need to be able to effectively report on and manage their revenue numbers if they wish to raise or wish to get debt. And that's where a business like Chargeify steps in. We do that for them, and we let them do what they do well or what they want to do, which is, I don't know, build a tool that manages log entries, build a tool that manages source code movement or security access. Let us do the billing stuff. You focus on what it is that's going to make you famous.
I love the answer. You know, it's interesting. You know, you use that example of telcos. One of the ways that some of these companies differentiate and compete is on the mechanisms or on the packages that they put in place to price differently, to package differently. And so, you know, you obviously compete on the nature of what your product is, but you also can compete on how it's paid for, how it's consumed, how it's billed. So obviously that becomes an area that you guys can step in and give people unbelievable flexibility and utility that they don't have to build themselves. Somebody's already built it and they can use it.
100%. And it's really on point, Jason, that you talk about billing itself being a competitive advantage. Billing was never a competitive advantage. It was just a headache, you know? You know, go back to telecoms, go into hosting. It's in many ways, it's still a headache, okay? So for me, there's one salient date in history from a billing perspective that I talk about, and it's the year 2006. And this is the BCAD analogy for billing for me, okay? There's everything that happened before and everything that happened after. What was the trigger event in 2006 that changes this, that makes the world different thereafter? Amazon Web Services entered the market. What's so significant about that? When Amazon came in, they used billing as their competitive advantage. Up until that point, I mean, IT services were delivered on a non-utility basis. Go back, you know, to the early 90s, these were delivered in terms of enterprise software deals. You buy your hardware from IBM or HP, it goes into a comms room. You buy your software from Siebel Systems or whatever ERP solution you wish to use. Everyone goes away for 3 years. 3 years evolve. The software company comes back with a newer version of the software. The hardware company comes back with a newer version of the hardware. We then move into the SaaS model, which was Salesforce, where we begin to consume stuff. But that's on a seat basis. And then we move to C plus feature. What's so significant about Amazon Web Services? Up until that point, there was no utility pricing. Amazon Web Services came in and said, don't pay for what you deploy, pay for what you consume. This was groundbreaking. From an Amazon Web Services perspective, were their servers faster than IBM's? No. You know, was their customer success better than Rackspace? No. You know, were they even cheaper? In a lot of cases, unless you went to reserved instances, no. And the bills were non-predictable. But what they offered was real value-based pricing. And that's what people want. So they took billing and rather than customer success or performance or price, and they made this their competitive advantage. That's incredible. So when we look, what does the future look like in terms of B2B SaaS? 20 years ago, and maybe I'm jumping forward too much, Jason, here. 20 years ago, the concept of raising money or exiting a business without solid, predictable revenue that was backed by contracts was insane. 7 of the last 12 successful tech IPOs have been around businesses that have usage-based models. And I include businesses like the IPO for Snowflake, which is one of the biggest in Nasdaq's history. This is a company that doesn't have contracts. It has at-will customers using them that can leave at any point in time over a 30-day cycle. They have no predictability in terms of their revenue. There's no contracts. It's madness if you were to look at this from 20 years ago. But today, this is becoming more and more the industry norm. Consumers are demanding value. We live in a very like high-driven communications world, omni-channel marketing and communications, social media, you know, traditional media above the line, all of these different things. It's like consumers want value, and value to them is a value-based pricing. Do not charge me for what I have access to. Charge me for what I consume, and charge me for what I consume down to the last widget or unit. That's where your competitive advantage around billing lies. And that's why it's so interesting. I get it. I'm a billing geek, but that's why it's so interesting, because this is changing, and it's changing the way we view business, the way we do business. It's changing the consumer's perception. It's changing the merchant's responsibility.
Yep,
it's really, really powerful stuff.
I love that. You know, one time I was in a meeting with Google, talking to their cloud team, and they literally said, I can't remember exactly the quote, but they bill per second of use. And they said, and we do that, and actually it's a fraction of a second, but they said, we do that because we want to earn your business every second. So at any point you want to turn it off because we're not living up to your standards, turn it off. You'll only get paid for what you use. And it was a really powerful marketing moment that they say, I can earn your business every second you use our capabilities.
It's absolutely 100%. And that is taking something which is traditionally within business been a headache, billing, and it's making it your competitive advantage. And that's fascinating. That is playing to the market. I mean, you talk about my background, Jason. In 2006, this inflection moment in terms of software and business, where Amazon Web Services launched and grew this business that's, you know, the fastest growing IT business in history now. I mean, at last check was about $35 billion or something in terms of total revenue. Incredible success, right? I wasn't in telecoms in 2006. I had my life savings in a hosting company in Ireland, okay? When Amazon launched, they launched across conferences and then drove this evangelist kind of marketing strategy that, again, when I look back with hindsight, it was just incredible. And we were in Chicago at HostingCon 2006. Amazon have a keynote, and we're all sitting there, the hosters, and we're like, we're Amazon here. Like, I mean, booksellers, you know. But bear in mind, it was 2006. It was a different company. And he stood up and he explained to us how the individual, his name was Vinesh, I can't recall his surname, but really impressive guy. He explained to us that, you know, when, you know, you come up to the Christmas fire period to 19th of December, there's an enormous amount of like server requirement in terms of running the stores and running the processes. But then you go to January post-Christmas, all of this is redundant. So they were going to use what was an emerging technology in virtualization through VMware and Hyper-V, you know, Citrix, and they were going to, you know, slice and dice up all this capacity, and they were going to sell it out at a lower cost than we could afford, because they basically had no cost of goods sold on it. About 15 minutes into that conversation, we all stopped laughing. And we all got very, very concerned. And by the time we left, we all went to the bar, but there was no happy hour that day. It was just a realization that, you know, it's like a traditional guitar player. The first time you heard Jimi Hendrix, it was like, you know, nothing's ever going to be the same again. I've seen something new. Like, this is the future. And, you know, how am I going to be a part of it? And that was all billing.
Well, the irony is you got disrupted by billing, and now your job is to help others do the same, to disrupt with billing.
Totally. I mean, and I feel when you go down, when you talk about value being derived per second, per fraction of a second, that's where we need to be. That's the conversation we need to be having. But again, I mean, when I talk about my telecom years and my hosting years and how difficult it is to manage this billing stuff, the complexities here get more and more and more as you drive into sort of higher fractional based billing models, down to the individual event, down to data movements, CPU cycles, movements of data between data pools, however it is you want to bill. The likes of Amazon bills on events. So within every platform, or you know, there are specific events that are captured and measured and often streamed. An email being sent, an API call, this is a specific event. So do you want to charge a basic subscription model around your service, or do you want to bill per event? If you want to bill per event, then you need to collect all those events and you need to have a platform that's able to apply the billing logic to those specific events and generate an invoice. This is hard. You know, when we launched event-based billing in March of last year, when we did it, we asked ourselves prior, why are our competitors not already here? These are businesses that are on NASDAQ. These are businesses that are raised, in some cases, hundreds of millions of dollars. Why has nobody taken what is clearly an enormously successful competitive advantage, an enormously powerful differentiator? Where's the proof? Amazon Web Services, Twilio, SendGrid, MailGun, you know, Datadog. All of these are event-based driven businesses that build in this fashion. And these are all emerging, either they are category kings or they're emerging with the potential to become one. Why is no one doing this? And what we found was the marriage between collecting billions of specific events coming back into a platform and then putting the billing logic on top. This is very difficult because billing platforms are not designed to manage this amount of data ingress. You send, you know, a couple of hundred million events at a billing platform, it will fall over. Quite simply, it's not designed to take that ingress. It's the technical equivalent of doing a DDoS attack on it. It's pretty much the same thing. So how do you get around this? Well, you get around this by building out the ingress engine. This makes sense. So, you know, who's good at that? MongoDB. They've raised like $422 million in the last count. Elasticsearch, like $168 million. You know, these are really complicated things to build, and they're expensive, and they're hard to run. So actually going and doing that, if you're a billing provider, it's a heavy, heavy, heavy lift. We took a back-to-front kind of approach to it. We solved the problem, which was managing the ingress. And we did that by acquiring a business called Keen, which going back was founded in 2011 and on the West Coast. It had raised $29 million with Sequoia as being the lead investor. It had entered our portfolio with Scaleworks. So it was something which was an addressable kind of acquisition for us. We took this in. We answered the problem around events. We integrated it deeply, brought the two together, and made it a single common entity. So we can now manage the billions of events that come in, and simultaneously, we can roll out the billing logic above that, and that's what we call event-based billing. So we don't suggest for one second that we invented this. We didn't. No, this was invented long before us. What we have done though is we've democratized it. Where you have a business like Amazon Web Services that is in a position to spend tens, hundreds, you know, of millions of dollars building out this kind of events and this kind of billing logic. A smaller startup company isn't in the same position. What we've done here is we've made this kind of billing technology available to them. And it's been pretty, you know, you've seen the profile and you've seen the success of Chargeify over the last sort of 18 months. It's been pretty game changing for us because we've delivered a product into the market that the market values and wants, and consumers want it.
Yep. Well, I'll say this. I have a couple of points. Number one, you're effectively taking any software product or B2B SaaS product and turning it into a utility. And anybody who's trying to sell a utility has to have a really smart way to do billing. And so you have a choice: build it yourself or rent it from somebody who already did it. And so it's a pretty clear option for companies trying to scale their business to go with Chargeify. The other aspect of it, Paul, is subscriptions and billing is a fairly crowded space. I mean, there is 15 names that are, a lot of them are doing really well, some not so much. But what I love about your strategy is you've really narrowed in to where you can dominate, where you have an unfair advantage. And I think you described it well with what you did with Keen and how you create this billing engine. So can you elaborate a little bit more about why B2B SaaS is your niche where you're going to dominate?
100%. So let me quickly touch on the crowded nature of the billing ecosystem. It is crowded. I'm not quite going to say, Jason, that it's a red sea yet, but it certainly isn't a blue ocean, right? What's interesting though in this crowded space is there has been an egregious lack of sort of development, lack of innovation within this space. Since, I mean, Zora emerged and, you know, Jianzhu built this company post coming out of Salesforce. He coined the expression, the subscription economy. Brilliant marketer, right? Brilliant. Great company. But they then went back and they focused on just basic subscriptions. You know, we had emerging companies coming through. Some of them were servicing telecoms. Some of them were servicing, you know, general box of the month kind of subscriptions. But nobody was innovating, you know? And for me, it's not enough. It just isn't enough to go to a consumer and try to sell them a service, which is embedded as billing on the premise that you'll give them a marginally cheaper cost or you'll give them a marginally better analytics engine. It's not enough. The risk in terms of moving from a billing perspective, it's just non-justifiable. Unless you offer them something that's new. So yes, it is a crowded space, but everyone's selling different flavors of the same thing, quite simply. And I don't want to be that. There are, like, you can be it and you can be successful. Not everyone needs to be Uber. I mean, if you privately owned Lyft, you'd be happy, you know? You don't need to own Coca-Cola. If you owned Pepsi, you would be happy. There's nothing wrong. I used to use the example Hertz and Avis, and, you know, when I talk about category design, I actually talk about the Avis model. It doesn't really hold any water since Hertz went bankrupt, right? But that's what I'm talking about. Like, for every Hertz, there can be an Avis. That's fine. I don't want to be that. Chargeify doesn't want to be that. For me, category design is everything. Okay, you must understand what your category is, and that's where you innovate. Once you understand what your category is and you get a defined target market, that's where the journey to success begins. Okay. The methodology around startups, you go back 20 years ago, prior to the whole movement towards strong category design. Okay. For me, the mindset was this: you know, people need safety pins. I'm a good salesperson and I know a lot about safety pins. Jason is a good engineer who knows how to make safety pins. Why don't we get Jason to make safety pins and then I'll go and sell them, okay? Unfortunately, that doesn't work because one, there are lots of people already selling safety pins and there's nothing differentiating about that. The fact that Jason is good at making safety pins is not a reason to make safety pins and try to launch them into the market. Loads of work need to be done. Okay, so for me, when I look at category, I look at it this way. Where's the opportunity in the market? And what other than safety pins can Jason make? That's what I want to do. So rather than saying, there's a market out there, people need subscription billing solutions. I know somebody that can do subscription billing solutions. Let's have them build it. And I'm a good salesperson. And let's go and sell it. And it will pile on top of the already 15, 20, 25 under innovative businesses that are out there. And we'll all compete for it. No. You know, yes, Jason can do billing solutions, but what else can he do? Actually, he knows an awful lot about streaming data and billing solutions. Well, let's find a different way to do this. Let's innovate around what that billing solution looks like. Let's take that to market. Let's not go to market around purely subscriptions because there's already people there. So that for me is category design. Let be market led as opposed to talent led. You know, super important. So that's the first point in terms of, you know, when I talk about the credit market and lack of innovation, very, very important. Why B2B SaaS? So for me, what is our category? Our category is complex billing solutions and subscription management. That's it. Okay. How do I know that's what our category is? And how do I know that I'm successful in terms of getting into that category? When people call us, they don't call us and say, I have an issue with my analytics. I have an issue with my rev rec. They ring us and they say, hey, I have an issue with my billing. My competitors are moving away from me because they're doing something specific and complex and I can't do it. They call us and they say, hey, I have an issue with the way that we're managing our subscriptions. So that's why I know, like, we're being successful when our customers are feeding back to us what our general category is. Like, why B2B SaaS? Why do I want to limit myself right now in 2021 into one specific industry cohort? Not even SaaS, B2B SaaS, okay? Domination, yeah? I want to be in a position that I can dominate in one area. I don't want to be Avis to Hertz. I don't want to be RC Cola to Pepsi or Coke. You know, I want to be the category leader in one area, and that area is B2B SaaS. First things last, is the total addressable market large enough for me to meet my medium to long-term goals? Yes. You know, is it a market where there is capital, where transactions can be completed? Yes. Is it a growth market? Yes. For me, they're the three big markers. All of those are answered. Okay, do I have a team that can develop billing and subscription management services that would be applicable to this area? You know, and note that I haven't said, what does my team skill set look like? Do I have a team? Yes, I do. Right. This is the target market for me, and this is the category. Let's go after that. Let's become, you know, the category king here in terms of, not in billing, let's be the category king for B2B SaaS companies for billing and complex subscription management. Let's just do that. If we can do that, we'll be successful. Lou Mormon, who is one of the partners in Scaleworks, he always says there's riches and niches. Let's find our niche and let's dominate there. You know, let's rule in that one small area rather than be banal and bland across a larger one.
I love the answer. Thank you so much for elaborating. You know, having spent a decent amount of time with your team, the folks who are executing your strategy, I think it's really powerful how much clarity you've given to them. They very clearly know where you guys can delight your customers and where you can't. I've seen your team say, no, not a fit, relatively quickly, which is amazingly efficient when you're trying to do big things. And I also think it's important to note that, you know, you guys are starting to get market recognition. You know, you show up on the Forrester wave, albeit in the far left, but over time, you know, you move your way up to the right. And that, you know, over time, that becomes a very useful tool in market recognition.
Yeah, I mean, well, around the team, like we gotta be strong on this. Real power comes, like, if you look at the 22 immutable laws of marketing, the law of sacrifice. That's where your real power comes. When you're strong enough to be able to sacrifice and say, okay, it's not for us. We cannot be everything to all people. We gotta choose. You know, if I was in a position to maybe I would have a different viewpoint if I'd spent my career in larger businesses, Jason, and, you know, capital was never an issue to me, but capital has always been a constraint. I've never been in a position to say, let's take on everything. You know, it can't be done in when you have a finite capital kind of position within your company. I'm not going to go out and raise $500 million in terms of a Series A in charge of fire or any other business. I don't believe that. I think that the clever way to do business is around picking the niche that you want to rule in, you want to be exceptional in, and going after that. Once you find that as well, this clarity, you know, people, they radiate towards it. People want clarity. They want to know what the mission is. They want to understand it. Yeah, I mean, my team understand exactly what they're looking for. Do we turn away business that comes to us that mightn't be specifically B2B SaaS? Maybe it's B2C. Obviously, no. We're all here to grow business. But if that B2C company or if that non-B2B SaaS company comes to us and says, hey, Paul, we need you to deviate away from your existing product roadmap and we need you to build us an integration into UPS so we can manage parcel delivery, we say, no, thank you. That's not going to happen. But I, you know what? Head across the road to our competitors. I'm sure they're happy to have that conversation. Maybe we're just not for you. You know, maybe the journey we're on is a journey you don't want to walk with us. And that's cool. Understand that, like, we don't have the resources. We don't have the team. And, like, we've doubled the number of developers we have in this company over the last 12 months. Well, sorry, last 18 months. So it's not like we're under resourced at all. I mean, we're a high growth, you know, we're a high sort of talent recruitment engine at the moment. But we got to know what we want to be famous for and focus on that. Otherwise, we'll be famous for nothing.
Exactly. Well, that's great. So you know, one of the traditions we have on this podcast is, you know, we ask people like you who are influencers in the industry, really kind of project out what's going to happen, what tools need to be used for B2B SaaS, but who influences you? Who do you pay attention? Who do you read? You shared a book. That's a great example.
So like, what I find funny, Jason, is when COVID happened, right, I kept on getting calls and was wondering why that was, right? I guess I was getting calls because I'm not the hop-in guy that's taken a business from nothing to a $6 billion valuation over a period of like 15, 16 months, right? I'm the sort of gnarly old guy with the battle scars, a bit like yourself, right? You know, when you're in this kind of crazy capital buoyant economy and there's money flying around, you know, you want to be talking to like Johnny over there in Hopin that's raised all this money at these brilliant valuations through COVID. And Hopin's a great company. I don't mean to make that sound like a one-trick pony. He's an excellent business person and it's an excellent platform. You know, who influences me? What the commonality in terms of guys in my venture? One, we read a lot. So the one thing you can be like, if you look, no matter how complex your issue is, no matter how complex the problem you're looking to solve, you read enough, you'll find an answer. And, you know, the likes of, you know, Gates, not that I'm comparing myself in any shape or form to guys of that stature, no way, but they're vociferous readers. They're like, you know, for example, is the wrong word, but they read enormous amounts. So like when I see an issue in terms of my sales team or in trial closing, you know, pitch anything immediately, okay, comes in. When I see that we have an issue with negotiation, never split the difference comes in. You know, when I want to talk about looking at a, you know, category design exercise within a company to drive strategy, or even what I call sort of, you know, re-category design, where you've gone down a specific category route and you need to back off and go in a different direction, play bigger. You know, all of these books are the Bibles in terms of how we should set our stalls out and how we should run our businesses. And, you know, the one thing you can be sure of, like somebody's already faced this problem. There are very few problems we're going to face in life or business that are truly unique to us. You know, they've been there before, and people have learned and people have failed and people have succeeded. And, you know, you look far enough and deep enough and there's somebody out there who's done this. So I don't want to go down into people that I respect, and follow. I don't do Elon Musk's of the world and stuff, like just boring. I look at from a book perspective. If you want to look at category design, you should replay bigger. You want to look at, you know, negotiation skills around your go to market. Why not look at, you know, Never Split the Difference? I mean, written by an FBI hostage negotiator. Pitch anything. Fanatical prospecting. If you feel that your marketing team isn't delivering sufficient opportunities back into your sales org, you got to get out there cold calling. You got to get out there in terms of prospecting. So these kind of areas, you know, I look in my own industry sector. I look at Shinzu that came out of Salesforce, a CMO, and built this great business of Azora. You know, huge amount of respect for him and what he's achieved. I feel that, you know, there's a level of innovation that's been lacking in that business. So there's areas that he can move forward with. I look at people that are opportune in terms of the opportunities that appear, you know, out of the blue, like, you know, the likes of Hopkins of the world, these guys that are able to go out and really seize these opportunities quickly and move and bring a team with them. Hugely respected. I look at disruptors in markets like Stripe. You know, these guys have come into a very crowded space where there are some really great companies like your own and et cetera, like, and they've managed to carve out a position for themselves. These are the kind of companies that I follow rather than, you know, people. You want to learn how to grow a business, and, you know, if you want a book that you can't put down, read the Walmart story, you know? I mean, it's a great story. I'm not sure how applicable it is now. Like, I mean, you look at, Jim Collins, Good to Great. It's great read. It's great around sort of category design as well, but play bigger. but it's like 30 years old. So a lot of the references are, you know, not particularly applicable anymore.
One of the things we also like to talk about, I mean, Chargeify is a bit of a tastemaker in an odd way. You know, we talk about the ability to differentiate your company based on how you bill. And so I would love to hear from you, a company that gets billing right and why.
An example from Chargeify as a very specific billing business of a company that's done something right. Okay, so Twilio is a great business when it comes to billing. Okay, this like very, very crowded space. You know, you're looking at a messaging platform that has managed to grow to that level at that speed. How did they do that? Did they have a better send rate than a traditional telecoms company or mobile telecom company that was sending messages? No, I mean, you send a text message over a specific platform, you gotta have an expectation that's gonna land, okay? Were they significantly cheaper? No, I mean, like, there's like, they might've had a disruptive price point at some point in time, but it's a competitive space. And I mean, there's only so much that you can negotiate in terms of the, in terms of, you know, your starting point and your ending point when you're operating at a mobile gateway level. So, you know, they were successful around billing, they were successful in that they were doing multi-attribute based billing on SMSs. People saw real value in it. Yeah, they had a great interface. They had a great UI that integrated into your platforms. But their billing engine was great. And you know, at a time when people were getting sick of the traditional telecoms companies and they were feeling that they were being gouged, you know, we were in this kind of you talk about a company that's done a good billing job in Twilio. I'll reverse it and say, who did a bad billing job? Who didn't deliver value to the consumer? Traditional telecoms companies. The whole mobile billing model is fundamentally wrong. I pay you $50, I get 500 messages, right? If I don't use 500 messages, they do not carry over. I still pay you $50. But if I go above 500 messages, you gouge me. There's too many communication channels in the world for this to work anymore. People are too informed. You know, millennials and those coming beyond them are too price conscious. They don't, they're not going to pay to get gouged anymore. They're not like me and you, where we accepted this for whatever reason, but we did. So this is a very bad billing model. Twilio comes in, shows real value-based pricing with a simple interface, gets everyone up and running quickly. They move to dominate. Amazing CEO as well, for the record, great leadership. And then, you know, the acquisition of SendGrid, they broaden out their platform in terms of encompassing mail in along with the SMS, with the messaging side. And that's a super strong, compelling kind of company with a great billing story that demonstrates real value.
Fantastic. Love the example. So last question. Do you have any podcasts recommendations for our listeners? You obviously are well-read. You might not have time to listen to podcasts, but are there any that stick out that help you on your commute during normal times?
So the short answer, Jason, is no, sorry. My commute is, I live about 4 minutes from my office. The first 2 years that I lived in the United States, I didn't have a car. I just Ubered everywhere. Because I live so close to my office. It's not something that I have on a commute basis. And when I'm in my office, typically I don't really have a huge amount of time to be jumping onto them. So like, no is the short answer. I should probably have researched a little bit in advance and then an answer to that. Right?
No problem. I'll give you some recommendations. Yeah. There are some good
ones. Please do. Yeah.
Yeah. My favorite one is the Jason and Scott show. It's all around e-commerce. It's not really about billing per se, but it's about all the things happening with brands, with Amazon, their strategies for going direct. It's a fascinating one. So put that on your 4 minute Jason commute. It'll take you about 2 weeks to finish one episode.
Yeah, like everyone thought I was weird over here because I refused to get a car. But I mean, I'm looking at it saying, well, I mean, I want to have a car so I can drive for 4 minutes each way. The car is going to cost me like $1,000 a month or something in terms of having it. Then I got gas in it. Then I got to put insurance around it. Like, Oh, and the Uber fare cost me $6. So I can be environmentally sound in terms of not adding to the emissions. I can save myself probably $1,000 a month in terms of my disposable income. And anytime I want to have a drink, I can have a couple of drinks and hop into an Uber and not be frightened of, you know, crashing my vehicle. So
you sound like an Irishman and a billing guy all together with your answer. That was perfect.
Yeah, there you, well, yeah, if I wouldn't be an Irishman if I didn't bring into play whiskey or alcohol of some nature.
Your words, not mine. But listen, Paul, this has been absolutely fantastic. Your insights around billing are amazing. We are thrilled to be a partner of Chargeify, and obviously the announcement's coming here shortly. But thanks for your time, and wish you nothing but success.
Jason, yeah, thanks. Thank you so much for having us on. I mean, strong businesses are based on strong partnerships. And I mean, I think the partnership that we have is a really strong one. I think it's going to be, I really am looking forward to seeing where we can bring it. Thanks, I really appreciate it. And I appreciate you.
You've been listening to the Commerce Connect podcast, brought to you by Digital River and edited at Matriarch Digital Media in Minneapolis, Minnesota. To learn more, head to digitalriver.com.